This week, we ask the question, are the Knight Templar truly Masonic? We've got a great article that comes direct from the Knight Templar magazine. There are many split opinions on this topic. We attempt to answer them in this episode. Then we're going to dive right back into Max Hindle's Ancient and Modern Initiation, Part 2, Chapter 5, The Last Supper and the Foot Washing. What does foot washing have to do with the occult journey? What does the sweet smell of the saints truly represent? And what truly is the Philosopher's Stone? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 490. 490 episodes of Masonic Education coming to you, all thanks to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners. In the news, I want to first mention the passing of the Duke of Edinburgh. I woke this morning to an email from my secretary at UGLE Lodge, and he had passed on the information to the membership here at our Lodge Internet. So the Duke of Edinburgh has passed, and he has lived a very long life, 99 years old. Brother HRH, right? The Duke of Edinburgh was passed and raised in Navy Lodge number 2612. You know, he never moved farther than Master Mason, but he was a regular paid-up member of the Lodge until his death. And just a really incredible and interesting individual in his entire life. You know, not without fault or anything like that, as you may have read in some of the information that's come out since his death was announced to the world. But of course, he also was somebody who was very much in tune with modernizing organizations and the like. So I think just an incredible individual and somebody who is part of our fraternity. It is indeed a sad day for the country and Freemasonry. I am, of course, recording this on Friday, the day that this has happened. So I do want to make sure that we pay our respects to a brother who has played a large part in Freemasonry in not only UGLE, but around the world, wherever he is acting as a brother. I'll put a link in the show notes to a obituary that was published, which I thought was quite touching and, you know, pretty honest about the man and what he had done in his life. I can't read it on the air, of course, because it comes from a news organization, but it'll be in the show notes for you to check out. I will read the post from the United Grand Lodge of England this morning, posted, "We are deeply saddened to hear of the death of His Royal Highness, Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. We pass on our sincerest condolences to Her Majesty the Queen and the rest of the royal family at this difficult time." And they invite you to join them on Twitter at 9 p.m. for a social edition of Time to Toast in memory of His Royal Highness Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. And of course, that is 9 p.m. in UK time, so it is past for us. But we learned of the passing somewhere around 6 a.m. on Friday the 9th. Moving on to some cheerier news. Those of you, those supporters, fellows contributors, producers, and legacy partners who did take part in the contest, I want to thank you all. I do have a winner. We had several brothers go and complete the quiz, quote-unquote quiz, to attempt to win this prize package that I put together just for the supporters of the show. And so before we announce those winners, let's go through and answer some of these questions, because I think it was fun to write these. And it was kind of cool to see what y'all knew about the show, and depending on how long you've listened, what you know about it. So here we go. The quiz was question one, how many episodes of the WCY podcast are there? Now, there were really three correct answers. The correct answer was, just by going to our website, you could see what was the latest episode up. That number would give you a correct answer. At that time, it was 489, but 488, 487, and even 486 were accepted. Which segment of the show was produced for a short time and retired? Illustrious Thoughts of a 33rd Brother? The Esoteric Minute? George Washington's Famous Recipes? Or Masonic Gripe? Of course, the correct answer was the Esoteric Minute. What Masonic podcast inspired the WCY podcast? Was it Ex Oriente, The Working Tools, Afterlodge, or The Digital Freemason? The answer was The Digital Freemason. How many microphones has Robert Johnson used over the years? 1, 4, 7, 2. I have used 4 different microphones over the years, and I think I'm finally on the one that I like the best. In 2017, which catastrophic event caused the WCY podcast to almost call it quits? A hard drive crash? My studio caught fire? A motherboard failure? Or a Grand Lodge sanctions to cease and desist? I had a motherboard failure, a smart board on the computer, which made it toast pretty much. How many skulls are in my studio? Kind of a fun but tricky question. 3, 6, 9, or 1? Well, I actually have 6. 6 skulls in the office, whether they're replicas, toys, or pictures. How many versions of the WCY producer pins have been created? 3, 5, 1, or 4? The answer is 4. We ran our first set, which was limited to just 25, which had these really awesome glazed cover, glazed enamel stuff done by Axel Foley out of the United Kingdom. Those were generously given to us and paid for by Brian Evichin, who at the time was turning pens, and we can't thank him enough for those initial investments. Where does the logo of the WCY podcast draw its inspiration? Does the artwork come from the Builders, Symbolism, A Treatise on the Soul of Things, Morals and Dogma, or Mackey's Masonic Encyclopedia? Well, this one, it comes from Mackey's Masonic Encyclopedia. What segment was retired after 248 episodes? The Masonic Minute with Steve Harrison, Adam's Book Reviews, Famous Freemasons, or Did You Know Masonic Edition? The answer is Famous Freemasons. We did 248 episodes of Famous Freemasons. Now, we could have done way more, and we probably still can, but we moved on. Now, this was a true or false question. The WCY podcast once produced a holiday gift guide. True or false? Well, the answer is true. In fact, it's always something that I want to do every year, but I don't always get to it. This one was fun. How many papers have been read on the show? Best guess, closest without going over. We had several people guess. Some were way too low, and nobody amazingly went over. On average, we read 2 or 3 papers per show. Now, in many of the shows, there are 3. So just based on that, there are over 1,300 papers that we've read on this program. In what year and month did the WCY podcast begin? January 2010, July 2011, March 2014, or September 2013? For the correct answer here, all you have to do is go to the website. It's right there on the supporters page, and you'll learn that we started in July of 2011. Why did the WCY podcast begin? Your options there were Robert's Grand Lodge asked me to do it, a $100 bet, a lack of education in my own mother lodge, or total boredom. The answer often was $100 bet, but that is not correct. I did get a $100 podcast kit that got me started, but what started it was a lack of education in my own mother lodge. When the WCY podcast started, how many other Masonic podcasts existed? 2, 10, 5, or 3? Well, officially at the time, there were 3. 3 Masonic podcasts which were available on iTunes. Now there are over 30. The WCY podcast is the longest running Masonic podcast in the world that is still creating new content. True, false, or it's tied with another? The answer is true. We are the longest running Masonic podcast in the world that is still creating content. The WCY podcast will retire new episodes and become a syndicated version of a podcast after episode 500. True or false? Well, that would mean that there are only 10 more episodes after this one before I don't create any more, but leave the rest of the episodes up forever. This, of course, is false. We'll create content until we just can't do it anymore. How many dues cards do I have? 5, 16, 2, or 33? Well, the correct answer here is 16. That's right, I pay 16 different dues cards. It gets crazy. Then we had some great answers to 3 essay questions. I'm not going to read you all these answers, but I do want to tell everybody out there that everybody who filled these out and gave a meaningful explanation really was awesome. So, what kept you active in Freemasonry? What is your fondest Masonic memory? And why should you win this ridiculous contest? We had a lot of people answer selflessly. They said, we shouldn't win this contest, but thank you for considering, you know, that kind of thing. And I want to thank everybody out there. So the thing you're all waiting for, who won? Well, coming in with the most points and winning by 1 point over another brother was Kevin Standen. So Kevin, congratulations. You've won. You will end up getting the ticket to Esotericon with all of the goodie bag stuff. You're going to get a Rider-Waite tarot deck and a brand new limited edition, because only 100 of these were made, Southern California Research Lodge Fraternal Review gift set of the Four Cardinal Virtues. And so that is coming to you as soon as I put it in a box and package it all up real nice for you. And, you know, we actually had the next four people underneath Kevin in terms of point value. I looked over at my shelf, and there sat four tarot card decks unopened. And so, you know what? I'm going to give those out, too. So coming up in second place was Christian Stebbins. So, Christian, I'm going to go ahead and mail you a tarot deck. Coming up right under that, we've got Brother TJ Williams. TJ, I'm going to send you a tarot deck. Tying with TJ, we had Andrew Lewis. So, Brother Lewis, loved your essay answers, by the way. I'm going to send you a tarot deck. And also, Sean Carruthers, you also were a runner-up there, and I'll send you a tarot deck also. So I'm going to send those out just as soon as I can. It'll probably be Monday before they get in the mail, just so you know. So if you're listening to this on Sunday night, they went in the mail pretty soon after listening and hearing this. So I want to thank everybody out there for doing this. And again, you guys are amazing. Thank you for contributing to the program. Thanks to everybody who entered the contest and gave me some awesome insights into your essays. You guys are amazing, and I hope you enjoy the things that I'm sending out. So let's now move on to this week's first piece, which comes from the brand new issue of Knight Templar Magazine, the April 2021 issue, number 4. Now, this article is entitled, "Are Knights Templar Truly Masonic?" by Sir Knight James A. Marples. Now, I am reading this from the actual print magazine. At the time of reading this, they haven't uploaded this issue to the website. So when it becomes available on the website, I will go ahead and add it into a link back to their website for you. So here we go. Are Knights Templar truly Masonic? There are some critics and detractors, both within and outside of the Masonic fraternity, who claim that the Knight Templar and Knight of Malta orders are not Masonic because of the exclusive Christian qualification. That is utter nonsense. The various branches of Masonry interpret the world from various points in history, from King Solomon's time to the present. Since each candidate makes his own solemn pledges on the Holy Bible or Holy Writ of his belief. Since much of Freemasonry pertains to the building of King Solomon's temple, it is only natural that the Old Testament be in the Bible on all Masonic altars. Second, the events of the New Testament often reflect events that occurred in the Old Testament. The original nine knights who convened in Jerusalem were said to have met at a building immediately next door to the site of King Solomon's temple. Their official name was the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and the Temple of Solomon. This close connection is undeniable. Therefore, most lodges have what I solemnly refer to as the First Testament and the Second Testament of Holy Scripture, bound in one volume upon the altar. Millions of men have joined over the centuries, and few have balked. Sadly, our modern times seem to have inspired some people to heckle or nitpick about the most trivial topics. One of Freemasonry's working tools is the square, an implement measuring 90-degree angles. When four squares are placed together, one perfectly adjacent to another, they form a cross. Such an image can be formed with matches. Squares are vital to the construction of rooms within buildings such as cathedrals. I have always enjoyed mosaic floors such as those sometimes seen in Masonic lodge rooms. Their composition forms another type of square which is composed of alternating white and black squares. A square is literally a building block. It can be paired with others or it can be aligned with others as in a staircase. The middle chamber lecture of the Fellowcraft degree is most impressive and says it all, including wisdom, strength, beauty, Tuscan, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian, composite, grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. The latter, are the 7 liberal arts and sciences, which every Mason is encouraged to study. That is probably why so many noted Masons have excelled in wonderful achievements in these areas, all done by the inspiration of the square. When my father joined Masonry, it was not necessary to join the Council of Royal and Select Masters in order to qualify to become a Knight Templar. In early 1945, my dad went from entered apprentice to fellowcraft to Master Mason in Sunflower Lodge 85 in Wichita, Kansas. He rapidly took the degrees of Royal Arch Masonry in Wichita Royal Arch Chapter 33, along with the others conferred by Mount Olivet Commandery 12, all in the same year. He later joined Wichita Council 12 of Royal and Select Masters, including the degree of Super Excellent Master in 1947. A statement on what Templary stands for was issued by the Grand Encampment Membership Committee. That proclamation states, quote, "Its culmination in the Masonic story began on the ground floor of King Solomon's Temple, and has left him with unanswered questions about a substitute. He has no idea that the Masonic story parallels the story of the Bible, which tells of the people who sought God but continually fell short of perfection in God's way. God then set his Son in the middle of them to give them a living, breathing example of his way of life. As the Old Testament prepared the way and set the stage for the coming of Jesus and the New Testament, so ancient craft masonry sets the stage and prepares the way for the orders of Christian knighthood. Ancient Templars were indeed the poor fellow soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. They were created to preserve, protect, and defend the Christian religion. Their proximity to the site of King Solomon's Temple made them natural allies to adherents of Judaism. Our whole Western Judeo-Christian world owes the Templars a debt of gratitude. By their words and deeds, they put pilgrims to the Holy Land on the level by escorting them on their journey with safety and solemnity. Modern Knight Templar are indeed Masonic, since these virtuous principles are admired and emulated in the modern context of Christian Masons helping others, regardless of whether the person is a Christian Mason or even a member of the craft. Holy Land pilgrimages have been sponsored by various grand commanderies. Modern Templars perform their sacred duty to bury the dead, comfort the widow, and educate the orphan, and shield the oppressed. The York Rite in the United States is composed of 4 bodies: the Symbolic Lodge, a chapter of Royal Arch Masons, a council of cryptic Masons, and a Knight Templar commandery. A memorial window inside Christ Episcopal Church in Ottawa, Illinois, was endowed in part by funds from the local Knight Templar. It is significant because it depicts some of the great tenets inculcated by Christianity and amplified by the honorable and ethical lessons of various Masonic degrees. For example, Lady Justice is depicted with a sword in one and the balanced scales of justice in the other hand. The globe and Holy Bible are depicted in another section of the window. It was appropriate since Templars knew the spatial symbolism illustrated by the scenes depicted by those windows. The commandery's 2 top orders, the Order of Malta and the Order of the Temple, are the capstone degrees of the York Rite, for which a Christian Mason can apply. There are several other honorary Masonic bodies, such as the Royal Order of Scotland, which require the candidate to be not only a Christian, but a Trinitarian Christian. A beautiful banner showing the commandery orders is shown below. You will notice that the banner of the Order of the Red Cross uses the word Masonry, and that under the Order of the Temple, the sacred name of Jesus Christ is noted prominently. To me, Templary doesn't discriminate, but rather offers a Christian Mason who holds both the Old and New Testaments holy, venerable, and sacred a Christian viewpoint, underscoring the compatibility of Christianity as a religion and Freemasonry as a friendship society. One other excellent source is the Lone Star Grand Commandery, which says the Christian Freemason has at his disposal a branch of the fraternity where he is free to interpret the teachings of the Symbolic Lodge according to his religious belief. The standard Holy Bible with Old and New Testaments is always displayed prominently in regular Masonic lodges. Usually, a King James Version is utilized. If a candidate is of another faith, his Book of Sacred Law is also displayed. The Bible is considered part of the furniture of a Symbolic Lodge and is deemed absolutely essential during all Knight Templar meetings. Sir Knight Albert G. Mackey, M.D., 33rd degree, who was eminent commander of the South Carolina Commandery No. 1 in 1844, states that the prelate is the 4th officer in a commandery of Knights Templar. His duties are to conduct the religious ceremonies such as the invocation and benediction. His jewel is a triple triangle, a symbol of deity, and within each of the triangles is suspended a cross in allusion to the character of the chivalric institution. The poor fellow soldiers of Christ and the Temple of Solomon were founded in Jerusalem in 1118 by Hugh de Payon, Geoffrey de St. Omer, and seven other French knights. It was consecrated to the protection of pilgrims and the defense of the Holy Land. The founding knights took monastic vows and were known as the Poor Knights of Christ. King Baldwin II, the French King of Jerusalem, 1118 to 1131, installed the order in a part of his palace on the site of Solomon's Temple for their residence, stables, and armory, from which it took its name, the Knights of the Temple or Templars. At the Council of Troyes in 1128, Pope Honorius II, who gave it the strict rule dictated by St. Bernard, a monk of the Cistercian order, who became the first abbot of Clairvaux, confirmed the order. The knights also received the white mantle as a symbol of purity for their life, to which in 1146 Pope Eugenius added the red Templar cross. The official papal sanction came from Roman Catholic Pope Honorius II on November 24, 1128 AD, just a decade later. Even our own grand encampment of the United States of America has superimposed a lodge emblem atop the conventional cross and crown emblem to show that the organizations are interwoven as a family of Freemasonry. This appears on the cover of every issue of the Knight Templar magazine. I prefer the standard Templar cross with a cross and crown inside the emblem as one unit. The Latin motto "In hoc signo vinces," "By this sign ye shall conquer," has always inspired me, ever since I was a little boy. And it continues to inspire me today. Speculative Freemasonry got its foothold in modern format in England more than 300 years ago, and has an equally impressive history inside the United Kingdom. The earliest reference to the modern Masonic Knight Templar activity in England can be found in the minutes of the Chapter of Friendship Royal Arch in Portsmouth, dated 1778, where it was worked as an appendant degree. In 1791, a grand conclave was formed comprising seven encampments with Thomas Dunkerley as Grand Master. By 1873, the Grand Conclave was known as the Great Priory, and encampments were known as preceptories. The ceremony is very realistic, and the regalia spectacular, based upon that worn by the medieval knights. Prospective candidates must be Master Masons, Royal Archmasons, and Christians. Most eminent Sir Knight Ned E. Dull was Grand Master of the Grand Encampment when I joined Templary in 1983. He published a commentary on Templar heritage in the United States, which indicates that, quote, "the oldest encampment, or commandery, for which records are extant, was in Charleston, South Carolina, active in 1780 and perhaps earlier. Other encampments were located along the Atlantic coast. In 1797, almost 30 years after the knighting of Paul Revere and Joseph Warren, Thomas Smith Webb, our Templar progenitor in the United States, identified a grand encampment in Philadelphia. An encampment, one other than Philadelphia encampment, and others in Harrisburg, Carlisle, Stillwater, and New York City. In 1800, Knights Templar of New London, Connecticut, participated in ceremonies of eulogy for General George Washington, and history records the conferral of the orders in the same year in Philadelphia and New York." End quote. The Grand York Rite Bodies of Missouri produced a most eloquent commentary that says, quote, "The Order of the Temple has been called the most beautiful of all the orders and degrees of Freemasonry. No Freemason who is a believer in the Christian religion should be satisfied until he has received this order, the capstone of the York Rite. This order emphasizes the lessons of self-sacrifice and reverence. It is meant to rekindle the spirit of the medieval Templars' devotion and self-sacrifice to Christianity." The history of the Masonic Order is long and convoluted, with the Order's ritual differing between that conferred in England and in the United States. That practiced in the United States has a slight militant zeal to the lessons of Christianity, whereas the English ritual is more allegorical. However, the American ritual is most impressive, and more emphasis is placed on the solemnity and reverence associated with the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Christ. For these reasons, it is entirely proper that the Order of the Temple, as well as the Order of Malta, be declared totally compatible within the Masonic fraternity. Sir Knight James Marples is a life member of Mount Olivet Commandery 12 in Wichita, Kansas, and currently resides in Texas. You can find his contact information in the actual article that comes direct from the magazine, which is published by the Knight Templar organization here, Grand Encampment, United States of America, and the issue is on their website. Brief comments on this particular article. I have seen many times in Masonic forums, whether on Facebook or other, people saying that there is some sort of disparity in the idea of a Christian-only order within Freemasonry. Certainly, it does seem that the highest offices or the most revered organizations or degrees certainly have this requirement of being Christian or even Trinitarian Christian. Does that make them inequitable? Do positions of power that exist that you can only get to if you're one of these religions, is that inequitable? I think that's the question a lot of the time. And of course, people will say, well, those really aren't positions of power because Masonry has only 3 degrees. Everything else is whatever. And of course, this is the way it is explained on paper. And of course, the other element is it fair to have a Christian-only organization within Freemasonry when there are no other well-known, at least, organizations within Freemasonry that are exclusive to any other religion? Say, a devout Jewish person, or perhaps somebody who worships any other system, whether that be a Muslim or even an Odinist or something along those lines. Could there be an organization that starts with a Masonic prerequisite and gain recognition today? One would have to assume. I don't think they could get it. We've seen other groups, such as the Widow's Sons, for instance, have trouble even getting recognition in some places and under some grand jurisdictions. And they're just a motorcycle group of Masons. So now imagine if you create a group specific to a particular religion, show that it's compatible with Masonry, and then create a version or a Masonic group that is invite-only and is very exclusive, and you have to be of that order before you can join this organization. That could create some real ripples. But therein lies the rub, is that it does exist already in our fraternity as a Christian association, and maybe that's okay, I don't know, because are the foundations of our organization, going from the Regis manuscript to the Cook manuscript to Anderson's constitutions to the Preston and Webb ritual, all of it is interwoven with religious symbology relating back to Christian archetypes, and of course the entire system of degrees is based on a foundation of Judeo-Christian lore. So does that give the Christian element a particular leg up when looking to found an organization that is Christian or Trinitarian Christian only? I found the piece to be really well done. A couple parts in it kind of reiterated some facts that it probably didn't need to, but to answer the question that it attempts to answer, which is, are Knights Templar truly Masonic? That's the question I want to pose to our Craftsman Plus. What are your thoughts? My own personal thought, and I'll add this to the post, is that it is Masonic and holds a special meaning for the Mason who is Christian. Let's be clear, there are many people who are of not the Christian faith, okay, who have joined Knights Templar. We know this. So it somewhat kind of begs the question on their prerequisite, how much it matters, and you name it, right? I mean, so there's a lot to be discussed here. What are your thoughts? I look forward to reading them in the comments as the weeks go on. And thank you so much to the Knight Templar magazine for all the work. You know, they never miss an issue, and they've continually created and made this magazine for a very long time, since the mid-20th century. Now, let's continue our journey reading Max Hindle's Ancient and Modern Initiation, Part 2, Chapter 5. Now, we're getting close to the end of the book, so bear with us. I know we've been reading this for several weeks going on, but I hope you're enjoying this look at Max Hindle's New Age thinking as he takes us through this concept of ancient and modern initiation. Well, here we go. Chapter 5, The Last Supper and the Foot Washing. We are told in the Gospels, which relate the story of the Christian mystic initiation, how on the night when Christ had partaken of the Last Supper with his disciples, his ministry being finished at that time, he rose from the table and girded himself with a towel, then poured water into a basin and commenced to wash his disciples' feet. An act of the most humble service, but prompted by an important occult consideration. Comparatively, few realize that when we rise in the scale of evolution, we do so by trampling upon the bodies of our weaker brothers. Consciously or unconsciously, we crush them and use them as stepping stones to attain our own ends. This assertion holds good concerning all the kingdoms in nature. When a life wave has been brought down to the nadir of involution and encrusted in mineral form, that is immediately seized upon by another slightly higher life wave, which takes the disintegrating mineral crystal, adapts it to its own ends as crystalloid, and assimilates it as part of its plant form. If there were no minerals which could thus be seized upon, disintegrated and transformed plant life would be an impossibility. Then again, the plant forms are taken by numerous classes of animals and masticated to a pulp, devoured and made to serve as food for this higher kingdom. If there were no plants, animals would be an impossibility, and the same principle holds good in spiritual evolution, for if there were no pupils standing on the lower round of the ladder of knowledge and requiring instruction, there would be no need for a teacher. But here, there is one all-important difference. The teacher grows by giving to his pupils and serving them. From their shoulders, he steps to a higher rung of the ladder of knowledge. He lifts himself by lifting them, but nevertheless, he owes them a debt of gratitude, which is symbolically acknowledged and liquidated by the foot washing, an act of humble service to those who have served him. When we realize that nature, which is the expression of God, is continually exerting itself to create and bring forth, we may also understand that whoever kills anything, be it ever so little and seemingly insignificant, is to that extent thwarting God's purpose. This applies particularly to the aspirant to the higher life, and therefore the Christ exhorted his disciples to be wise as serpents, but harmless as doves, notwithstanding. But no matter how earnest our desire to follow the precept of harmlessness, our constitutional tendencies and necessities force us to kill at every moment of our lives. And it is not only in the great things that we are constantly committing murder. It was comparatively easy for the seeking soul symbolized by Parsifal to break the bow wherewith he had shot the swan of the Grail Knights when it had been explained to him what the wrong he had committed. From that time, Parsifal was committed to the life of harmlessness, so far as the great things were concerned. All earnest aspirants follow him readily in that act, once it has dawned upon them how subversive of soul growth is the practicing of partaking of food which requires the death of an animal. But even the noblest and most gentle among mankind is poisoning those about him with every breath and being poisoned by them in turn. For all exhale in death-dealing carbon dioxide, and we are therefore a menace to one another. Nor is this a far-fetched idea. It is a very real danger which will become much more manifest in course of time when mankind becomes more sensitive. In a disabled submarine or under similar conditions where a number of people are together, the carbon dioxide exhaled by them quickly makes the atmosphere unable to sustain life. There is a story from the Indian Mutiny of how a number of English prisoners were huddled in a room in which there was only one small opening for air. In every very short time, the oxygen was exhausted, and the poor prisoners began to fight one another like beasts in order to obtain a place near the air inlet. And they fought until nearly all had died from the struggle and asphyxiation. The same principle is illustrated in the ancient Atlantean mystery temple, the Tabernacle in the Wilderness, where we find a nauseating stench and a suffocating smoke ascends from the altar of burnt offerings where the poison-laden bodies of the unwilling victims sacrificed for sin were consumed, and where the light shone but dimly through the enveloping smoke. This we may contrast with the light which emanated clear and bright from the seven-branched candlestick fed by the olive oil extracts from the chaste plant, and where the incense symbolized by the willing service, devoted priests rose to heaven as a sweet savor. This, we are told in many places, was pleasant to deity, while the blood of the unwilling victims, the bulls and the goats, was a source of grief and displeasure to God, who delights most in the sacrifice of prayer, which helps the devotee and harms no one. It has been stated concerning some of the saints that they emitted sweet odor, and, as we have often had occasion to say, this is no mere fanciful story. It is an occult fact. The great majority of mankind inhale during every moment of life the vitalizing oxygen contained in the surrounding atmosphere. At every expiration, we exhale a charge of carbon dioxide, which is a deadly poison, and which would certainly vitiate the air in time if the pure and chaste plant did not inhale this poison, use a part of it to build bodies that last sometimes for many centuries or even millennia, as instance in the redwoods of California, and give us back the rest in the form of pure oxygen, which we need for our life. These carboniferous plant bodies, by certain further processes of nature, have in the past become mineralized and turned to stone instead of disintegrating. We find them today as coal, the perishable philosopher's stone made by natural means in nature's laboratory. But the philosopher's stone may also be made artificially by man from his own body. It should be understood once and for all that the philosopher's stone is not made in an exterior chemical laboratory, but that the body is the workshop of the spirit, which contains all of the elements necessary to produce this elixir vitae. And the philosopher's stone is not exterior to the body, but the alchemist himself becomes the philosopher's stone. The salt, sulfur, and mercury, emblematically contained in the three segments of the spinal cord, which control the sympathetic motor and sensory nerves, and are played upon by the Neptunian spinal spirit fire, constitute the essential elements in the alchemical process. It needs no argument to show that indulgence in sensuality, brutality, and bestiality makes the body coarse. Contrariwise, devotion to deity, an attitude of perpetual prayer, a feeling of love and compassion for all that lives and moves, loving thoughts sent out to all beings and those invitably received in return, all invariably have the effect of refining and spiritualizing the nature. We speak of a person of that sort as breathing or radiating love, an expression which much more nearly describes the actual fact than most people imagine. For as a matter of actual observation, the percentage of poison contained in the breath of an individual is in exact proportion to the evil in his nature and inner life and the thoughts he thinks. The Hindu yogi makes a practice of sealing up the candidate for a certain grade of initiation in a cave which is not much larger than his body. There he must live for a number of weeks, breathing the same air over and over again to demonstrate practically that he has ceased exhaling the death-dealing carbon dioxide and is beginning to build his body therefrom. The philosopher's stone, then, is not a body of the same nature as a plant. It is pure and chaste, but it is a celestial body, such as the whereof of St. Paul speaks in the 5th chapter of the 2nd Corinthians, a body which becomes immortal as a diamond or a ruby stone. It is not hard and inflexible as the mineral. It is a soft diamond or ruby, and by every act of the nature described in the Christian mystic is building the body, though he is probably unconscious thereof for a long time. When he has attained to this degree of holiness, it is not necessary for him to perform the foot washing so far as concerns the physical pupil who helps him to rise, but he will always have the feeling of gratitude symbolized by that act toward those whom he is fortunate enough to attract himself as disciples, and to whom he may give the living bread which nourishes them to immortality. Students will realize that this is a part of the process which eventually culminates in the transfiguration, but it also should be realized that the Christian mystic initiation, there are no set and definite degrees. The candidate looks to the Christ as the author and finisher of his faith, seeking to imitate him and follow in his steps through every moment of existence. Thus, the various stages which we are considering are reached by a process of soul growth which simultaneously brings him to higher aspects of all these steps that we are now analyzing. In this respect, the Christian mystic initiation differs radically from the process in vogue among the Rosicrucians, in which an understanding upon the part of the candidate of that which is to take place is considered indispensable. But there comes a time at which the Christian mystic must and does realize the path before him, and that is what constitutes Gethsemane, which we will consider in the next chapter. All right, how about that? You know, we didn't really talk too much about the Last Supper, aside from what was going on with Jesus of Nazareth at this particular event, giving up his ministry at this point, right? It has come to a completion. But what was enjoyable to me here in this particular chapter is how we actually get some great insight here from Hindel, talking about the archetype of what's going on, the philosopher's stone and the human body, right? This should be very well understood by Masons today when we talk about, you know, the body is the temple and all of these things, because this is essentially what we're practicing. And there is this tie-over in this particular New Age Christianity text that Hindel has produced, this ancient and modern initiation. And so my question then for our Craftsman Plus revolves around the idea of the alchemist, not the book, the alchemist and the philosopher's stone. What are your personal thoughts on the idea of alchemy? Whether we're thinking about the literal transformation of lead into gold, or we're talking about good men into great men, or we're talking about, the green lion, or whatever else the case, leave your thoughts about alchemy and how it relates to the Masonic journey. That's it for this week. I hope you have enjoyed. We will be back next week, of course, with an all-new episode. And I think we'll have a new Masonic Minute as well. Thank you so much once more to our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners. We're looking forward to putting together our episodes with our legacy partners coming up this year. It'll be the first year with a few episodes coming that will be put together by and directed by not me. I will be, of course, doing the readings and whatnot. I'll be working with our legacy partners to come up with the content and the theme for the episode. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.